Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 60 Minutes interview with the recently fired White House Chief Strategist Stephen Bannon, in which he accused the Republican establishment of trying to nullify the 2016 election, saying that the House and Senate leaders, quote, do not want Donald Trump's populist economic nationalist agenda to be implemented. Adele Stan, a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, who covers the intersection of religion and politics, joins us to discuss how Bannon's patron, the right-wing megadonor Robert Mercer, is ready to pour millions into primaries to defeat incumbent Republican senators Mitch McConnell supports, replacing them with Tea Party zealots from the fringes of politics and, in some cases, sanity, such as Arizona's chemtrails Kelly Ward and Alabama's Judge Roy Moore, who wants to replace the U.S. Constitution with the Ten Commandments. Then we'll examine the tragic situation in Myanmar, Burma, where, according to the UN Commissioner for Human Rights, the persecuted Rohingya Muslim minority is being ethnically cleansed by Buddhist vigilantes and the Burmese military, who have ruled the country for decades. A leading specialist and prominent scholar who has made many trips to Myanmar and is writing a book on the Buddhist-Muslim conflict, who, because of his close relationship with political opposition figures at risk inside the country, prefers to remain nameless, joins us. We'll discuss the roots of this conflict and the silence of Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. Then finally, on the 16th anniversary of 9/11, we'll assess the effectiveness of the $1 trillion response to the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the averted attack on the Capitol, and speak with Dr. John Mueller, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies and Professor of Political Science at The Ohio State University and author of Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. And joining us now is Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect and a contributor to Sirius XM Progress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Adele. And Stephen Bannon, of course, got pretty high ratings last night, and he's at least 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes got high ratings with Charlie Rose interviewing Stephen Bannon. Lots of headlines came out of it, the most prominent being that Bannon said that President Donald Trump's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey was perhaps the greatest mistake in modern political history. And that's up there, I guess, in the lexicon of Monica Lewinsky and the Iran-Contra scandal.
Iran-Contra, right.
Yeah. So, you know, what's fascinating about that is I thought he was an interesting guy, and he's obviously very smart. You don't necessarily agree with him, of course, but you got to admit that he's no fool.
No, he's no slouch.
Yeah, but the idiots that are running that White House that have Trump's ears are all still in there. Ivanka, Jared, and Stephen Miller, all of whom advised Trump to fire Comey because they thought the Democrats would love that. How stupid
right.
could you be? I mean, clearly Bannon does not agree with Ivanka and Jared, or Javanka, as he calls them.
Right. Well, you know, my colleague at The American Prospect, Paul Waldman, wrote today about how what that signals in Bannon's estimation, Ian, is that Bannon sees the potential for the Mueller investigation to take down the Trump presidency. Otherwise, why else would it be the biggest mistake? You know what I'm saying? I think that I concur with Paul on that. I think Bannon really does see the danger there.
So in calling it a waste of time, there's nothing to the Russian investigation. It's a total and complete farce. Russian collusion is a farce. That's him, spreading disinformation? You think he's actually quite, if he says it's the worst political decision, then the consequences of which must be pretty grave, right? So you don't buy what he's saying about the Russian thing being a farce.
Well, see, he's very cleverly constructed his answers to Rose's questions so that he really does have some maybe not plausible deniability, but some deniability built in to the claim that you are making. He would say it's not disinformation because his problem with the Mueller investigation, well, his problem with the Comey firing is that it led to the Mueller investigation. And his problem with the Mueller investigation is the breadth that of the investigation, where he sees Mueller taking it, which is into all of these different financial dealings of various members of the campaign and likely Trump himself, right? Mm-hmm. Prior to the campaign, so he could say, well, he believes that there's no collusion, but the problem is the breadth of the investigation. You know, it could just be some bad business deals. You know.
Well, the overall puzzlement that I was left with is that I like some of his ideas. For example, when he said that it's a waste of time and money spending $1 trillion on modernizing the nuclear arsenal, the best way to not spend that money would be to make a deal with the Russians, who have a similar arsenal. Theirs actually is a little more modern than ours. Mm-hmm. And save a hell of a lot of money. You'd rather invest that in schools and roads, etc., and infrastructure. So that makes sense. A lot of what he says makes sense, but then it's always contradicted by the reality of who they put in there in this government. You can't have a functioning government in this country with these horrible people they put in. I mean, so...
And it's not simply that they're horrible people. I mean, the whole climate change denial project of this White House makes any kind of remedy for many of our ills really, really difficult, almost impossible.
Right. So you know, when he talks about China, containing China, for example, saying it's a big threat, it's stealing all our intellectual property, all of which is true. But what was the first thing that Trump did? Get rid of the TPP, which was a way that Obama had organized the neighborhood to contain China. So...
Well, exactly. And, you know, and the other side of this is, you know, it goes beyond before Bannon, is the Republican antipathy toward any spending abroad. And China's, you know, gathering economic clout has a lot to do with having invested in other developing nations all around the world.
Including Myanmar, where they built a pipeline all the way to the Indian Ocean, and their gain is our loss. Since Trump came in, the U.S. has pulled back. Obama visited Burma twice. Now, of course, on today's program, we're talking about the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingyas. It's not a pretty picture, but the U.S. has abdicated its role there, and China has filled the vacuum. So those are the things that I find puzzling about him, Stephen Bannon, is some of what he says makes sense, but it's contradicted by the kind of people they've chosen in the cabinet and their agenda and what's been passed so far by the House, and mostly through changes to regulations. And it all sort of makes you wonder what the real agenda is here. He makes Trump make sense, but what Trump is doing doesn't make sense. And again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics, and she's currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect and a contributor to SiriusXM Progress. So I guess he is, you know, pretty much a Tea Partier in the sense that he's going after the mainstream Republicans, many of whom in the U.S. senators seeking re-election in 2018.
Right.
He has a lot of funding from the mega donor Robert Mercer, who is already spending money to defeat Senator Jeff Flake in Arizona. But of course, the person they put up, Chemtrails Kelly, is a complete nutcase. And they'll primary Senator Dean Heller in Nevada with another nutcase. And the piece de la resistance of all nutcases is, of course, Bannon's preferred candidate for the Alabama Senate seat. He's backing Judge Roy Moore, the fundamentalist fellow. So again, much of what he said on the 60 Minutes interview, where he seemed reasonable and very smart. So what would the motive be of having these Tea Party bomb throwers in there? What's the purpose there? And what's the strategy?
Well, I think the strategy is, you know, it's ironic, but like Donald Trump, you know, Bannon sees opportunity in chaos. And, you know, he thinks in very apocalyptic terms. So there's a few things going on. I mean, when Bannon talks about the establishment in the Republican Party, and he's not talking about simply who you and I might think of as the establishment, such as the Bushes, right, or Nancy Kassenbaum's family or people like that. He's considering the Koch brothers the establishment. And
he's not far wrong. He's not far wrong.
They've bought the
whole Congress.
They own the apparatus. That's right.
And they're getting their agenda passed. That's the only stuff. The only achievements of this Congress so far and this administration have been rewarding the Koch brothers with offshore drilling, tar sands, crippling the EPA.
I would say that, and giving the religious right what they wanted in terms of women's rights, anti-women's rights, and anti-LGBT rights. So I think you're right, those are the two constituencies, and they're often intertwined, you know, that the Trump administration has, you know, been serving. In terms of the whole... So you have basically, you know, the Mercers who are Bannon's patrons, supporting him in a number of different efforts of his, including Breitbart News, in which they've invested some $10 million, and the Government Accountability Institute, which is the nonprofit that produced the fact-challenged book Clinton Cash, that shaped one of the narratives of the presidential campaign, and his involvement in Cambridge Analytica, which was a new kind of data mining company that the Trump campaign did use, that actually used Facebook profiles to determine outcomes in certain precincts. Anyway, all of the, you know, those enterprises are supported by the Mercers, who Robert and Rebecca Mercer, father and daughter team, who are billionaires. And they would really like to have a piece of the kind of action that the Koch brothers have in terms of being really deciders of the direction of the party. However, the problem is the Koch brothers built a large infrastructure over a period of decades, and now the Mercers are coming in. They're the new kids in town. They're the new money. So the only way they can really challenge the Koch brothers is to challenge candidates who are backed by the Koch brothers, which would be the incumbents in the House of Representatives. So this becomes a very internecine battle in the Republican Party, sort of a battle of the oligarchs, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, you know, Bannon is taking this.
So when Bannon went to town on Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, who he really sort of singled out for scorn, saying that
right.
that they're basically sabotaging the president's agenda, and they don't want him to succeed,
right?
Whereas Bannon does. So they're all owned by the Koch brothers. So this is a hostile takeover of the Republican Party by Robert Mercer. Is that the way you see it?
Well, I think it's an attempt at least being a force to be reckoned with, at the very least, and a hostile takeover. If he thought he could do it, he just might. But I also wonder how much Mercer really wants to control the whole situation, and how much he would rather just be, you know, causing trouble to the establishment and winning that way. But leaving it to them to run, you know, all of this big infrastructure that has been built to turn out voters.
Right, but control is not a word that sits well with the Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party. Nobody can control them. Boehner had lost his job as Speaker, and Paul Ryan is just under siege. I don't think anybody would ever want to be Speaker with those characters around, would they?
No, I mean, Ryan almost didn't take it, you know.
Yeah.
Ryan really was, I don't think, really looking for that job. He was the chairman of a powerful committee, and the kind of profile that could have launched him again into the national spotlight should he have wanted to, you know, make a shot for the presidency. So, yes, you're quite right. I mean, both McConnell and Ryan have been really under siege by Bannon and his ilk for quite some time. The Freedom Caucus has been there for a while before, you know, Bannon, there were those forces in the Congress. And the Republican Party has been on the verge of, you know, cracking up numerous times. And I've always felt that Democrats have been somewhat, you know, hapless in that they haven't traditionally done a good job at setting wedges. But the recent deal that Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi made with Donald Trump, you know, could have, to keep the government open from by raising the debt ceiling, could actually, you know, do some of that wedge setting.
Right, but this shows you how low the bar is set. We're having a discussion about the idea that the American government doesn't shoot itself in the foot and destroy the full faith and credit of the United States and lose the power of the dollar being the reserve global currency, which gives the U.S. enormous global advantage. That the fact that somebody didn't do that is a good thing. Boy,
I know.
Has the bar been set low here? I mean,
thank you for giving us that context. You know, even I get so spun far out from like how low that bar is.
You know,
it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary.
So when Bannon says, you know, that the Republican establishment is trying to nullify the 2016 election and it's a brutal fact we have to face, they don't, Paul Ryan and McConnell do not want Donald Trump's populist economic nationalist agenda to be implemented. Is he right, do you think? I mean, I don't even know what if the people that he's talking about backing in that race, if they're the populist nationalist economic agenda, then I don't blame any of these guys for being resisting that. But what did you make of that?
Well, I think more to the point, you know, I mean, if I don't know, you know, what the parallels are between Judge Roy Moore, who is, you know, most famous for defying a court order to remove a religious monument from the grounds of a courthouse, and say, you know, the opponent to Dean Heller, I don't, you know if they are even parallel to each other. I think the larger point is, who holds the power to remove Donald Trump from office, Ian? That really is Paul Ryan, because until Paul Ryan, you know, gives a thumbs up on articles of impeachment, which have to come from the House of Representatives, it's not going to happen. But if Ryan decided it should happen, it could, you know, and Ryan won't decide that, of course, I think, without a nod from the Koch brothers. But nonetheless, I think that's really the point that Bannon is getting at there.
Well, just in closing, then, how much, you know, you've got the, as you mentioned, the Democrats being feckless. A lot of people on the left are, first of all, they're, as much as Bannon is saying there's no there with the Russia investigation, even though, as you point out, the fact that he thought it was the most catastrophic mistake in modern political history to fire Comey, which led to the special prosecutor, then it's clearly something he's afraid of there. But, you know, as much as Bannon is saying there's no there with the Russian thing, I'm getting all kinds of emails from the left saying, you know, where's the proof? Where's the proof? Which, of course, is the mantra from RT and from Sputnik.
Right.
So our politics have become topsy-turvy, and the Russian thing seems to be bringing out the worst. But at the end of the day, if the Democrats don't have a narrative, a plan, some candidates, and all they're counting on is impeachment, then I think the Republicans would win in 2018 and 2020.
I think you're quite right, because if you look at how acutely the Republican congressional districts that are held by Republicans, I'm talking about the House of Representatives now, how acutely they are gerrymandered. It's very, very tough for Democrats to win in those districts, if even possible, you know, in the best of circumstances. So so between the fighting on the left over the Russia, whether the Russia collusion claims are valid, I believe they are, or the ongoing wars between, you know, people who supported Bernie Sanders and people who supported Hillary Clinton in the primary. I mean, unless the left starts to come together a little bit and the Democrats learn how to, you know, message and present candidates, I agree with you. They, as much of a mess as the Republican Party is, it continue to remain in power.
And the Democrats might well lose a senator. The crook from New Jersey is in trouble. So,
yes, Menendez is on corruption trial,
Well, on that cheery note, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it, Adele.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect and a contributor to Sirius XM Progress. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into what the UN says is the ethnic cleansing of Rohingyas in Myanmar. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is a specialist on Myanmar-Burma, a prominent scholar who's made many trips to the country and is writing a book on the Buddhist-Muslim conflict, but prefers to be anonymous because of his close political contacts in the country whose lives may be put in danger. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Thank you.
And the United Nations top humanitarian official has referred to what is happening in Myanmar as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya Muslims. And this is not the first time that they've been persecuted. There was an exodus of boat people a while back. So this seems like an ongoing tragedy, or at least a long-standing one.
Yes.
And what has escalated the current round of persecution of the Rohingyas?
I think the most recent development has to be linked to events that occurred last October. A group of resisting Rohingya, we're not really sure who exactly was involved. There may have been others involved as well, but clearly a local group and not a group that would have had ties to any kind of international militant Muslim group, attacked a border post and killed about 10 Burmese border guards. And in the aftermath of that, the Myanmar army came in to conduct what they call clearance operations. And from a report issued by the UN, published in February, which was based on over 200 interviews with Rohingya refugees who had made their way to Bangladesh. And this was about, these are interviews with people who are among the 75,000 refugees who managed to get across the border at that time. The severity of the clearance operations were off the charts, I would say, and the conclusion of the UN report was that, you know, rape and murder had become a methodology to, you know, drive Rohingya Muslims out of this most far western part of Myanmar. So I think, you know, from my discussions with Rohingya leaders over the past few months, I heard a sense of hopelessness, grave disappointment in the National League for Democracy government led by Aung San Suu Kyi, and a feeling that of hopelessness, which was very worrisome because these leaders are elderly people, and they worried very much about what the younger people were going to do in response to this situation. And I think that's what we're seeing now. There was an attack on 30 police stations or military settings on August 26th, the day after there was a report issued by Kofi Annan, his committee. Everyone had been waiting for that, what his recommendations would be for ameliorating the situation out in Arakan or the Rakhine State. And the Myanmar army then, at the request of a lot of people from the Rakhine State, sent out additional troops and now has been engaged in, you know, all the reports are really horrific in terms of the numbers of villages that have been burned down, the number of people who've been killed. And that's why we have over 300,000 Rohingya people now making their way on foot across the border into Bangladesh. That's sort of the recent history of this, but you're right, it's been festering for quite a long time. Some would take it back to the 1930s to an anti-South Asian sentiment towards people from India in general, or people from South Asia in general, who had come to Myanmar during the time of the British colonial period. And now that kind of the standard narrative that you will hear from many Burmese people is that, you know, it was during the time of the British that so many of these Bengali Muslims, and they refer to them as Bengalis, they refused to recognize the term Rohingya. It was during this time that so many came into this part of Myanmar. Of course, you know, during the time of the British Raj, there was no border until 1937 between what is now Myanmar and, you know, what is now India or Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's this general feeling, especially amongst the Arakanese Buddhist people who live in the Rakhine State, who have, you know, primordial claims on that region, that they're being overrun by this influx of Bengali Muslims. And so when you talk to them, they and Burmese will say that in general they're afraid that their country eventually is going to become another Malaysia or Indonesia, countries that were at one time Buddhists and of course now are very much Muslim countries. So the logic amongst the Buddhists, amongst the Buddhist monks, is that the country really exists to support the religion. And so if the country is threatened, then the religion is going to be threatened. And a lot of the understanding that they've sought to perpetuate, these conservative militant monks who are associated with a group called the Mabata, is that, or what they do is they will upload the international geopolitical situation to interpret what is happening locally in Myanmar. So there's a lot of talk about these are now Muslim terrorists, and there are a lot of assertions about international connections that are feeding this. There was even a claim last week that came out of the state councilor Aung San Suu Kyi's office, I think. I'm not completely sure exactly where it came from, the government, that even international NGOs are conspiring or colluding with Rohingya activists in, you know, in order to foment trouble out in this region of Myanmar. So it's a very ugly situation right now. And I think it's compounded by the fact that there's nothing really like national public radio in Myanmar. It was a country that was closed for over 50 years under military rule, and so information has always been sort of tightly contained. And so there's now just a morass of erroneous information actually coming from both sides on social media. And this just compounds the situation, makes it even worse.
And again, I'm speaking with a leading expert on Burma, Myanmar, a prominent scholar who's made many trips to the country and is now writing a book on the Buddhist-Muslim conflict, but prefers to remain nameless because of his close contacts to political leaders inside the country who may well be persecuted by the military government, even though there is a fig leaf of a civilian government, as you mentioned, led by the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991, Aung San Suu Kyi, who has not distinguished herself at all. Some people give her the excuse that she simply can't say anything because of the military government and its powers. But the Dalai Lama has come out questioning her silence, as has Bishop Desmond Tutu. So, but just a little bit more of the history. You mentioned how the British brought in Bengalis, as they're called, Muslims, into the country during the colonial period. But during World War II, of course, my understanding is that the Muslims actually fought with the British against the Japanese occupiers, whereas the Buddhists collaborated with the Japanese. Is that right?
In general, that's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're right.
So let's go to the last time there was a persecution and an exodus were largely boat people. So what prompted that one? Because this one seems to, this round, you point out, has been prompted by an attack on a police station. But
we need to back up a little bit then from last October to 2012. And that time signals the opening up of Myanmar and the election of, I wouldn't say it's a fig leaf, I'd say, they're sharing power with the military, and the military holds very important portfolios in the government, and also 25% of the seats in parliament. But what happened in 2012 is that there have been for a long time simmering problems between the Rohingya and Arakanese Buddhists. And in 2012, an alleged rape of a Buddhist woman occurred by three Muslim men, it is said. And this is sort of the beginning of the narrative of the contemporary situation. And that was followed, unfortunately, by the murder of 10 Muslims who were riding on a bus in the same state. And following that, there was a lot of tension building up in the town of Sitwe, which is the capital of the Rakhine State. And it broke out into a terrible imbroglio where hundreds of houses were burned, mostly Rohingya, but also on the other side. And in the aftermath of that, the military put almost the entirety of the Rohingya population, over 100,000 people from this city, this region of Myanmar, into an IDP camp. And there's one IDP camp outside of Sitwe where there are still 100,000 Rohingyas who are encamped. And they're not allowed freedom of movement unless they have to go for extraordinarily medical procedures. There's smaller IDP camps in the same region where Rohingyas were languishing. And, there's no opportunity for work. They're entirely dependent on international NGO help, Save the Children, the World Food Program. So the only jobs in these camps were, working for the NGOs. So that no educational facilities were provided. so the people were virtually quarantined in a kind of apartheid situation, and that led many of them to try to escape by boat, mostly trying to get to Malaysia, and they were often, you know, victimized by pirates. And Reuters ran an incredible investigative story about how over 100 graves in southern Thailand were found of Rohingya people, and they had been in camps where they had been were being sold into, or, you know, in human trafficking rings and so forth. And that led to a major conference with Myanmar, Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia. The U.S. were observers. And after that, the number of people trying to escape by boat diminished remarkably, because the word just finally got out that the chances of succeeding, of escaping through that route, were just too perilous. There were too many people who were not making it to their destinations. So that just has led to further frustrations. It's kind of like all escape routes have been blocked. In this recent situation, starting on the 26th of August or so, initially the Bangladesh border guards were sending people back into Myanmar. But, I think there was international pressure put on them to allow these people in, and now they've been allowing them in, but the conditions are, there's no place for them. I mean, the refugee camps are...
Well, it's a terribly poor country to begin with as well.
Yes, exactly.
So let's just go up to date then, and this attack on the border post or the police post by these Rohingyas, they weren't armed with modern weapons. They had clubs and knives.
Pretty much a real ragtag affair.
Right. So they provided the Burmese military, which had been running this country for decades, with an excuse, surely. And that seems to be the situation.
I think they've kind of realized that. Just yesterday they offered a ceasefire, but the government said they weren't going to negotiate with terrorists, as they've labeled them now. Mm. I think the almost the karmic effect of this has just been so deleterious and so tragic. Mm-hmm. I think that sense of hopelessness amongst the people, I could feel this earlier this summer when I was in the country. Rohingyas would say to me, we don't know what to do. So, I mean, there was the sense that they were totally at a dead end. And so this attack is really, I think, born out of desperation. It's also born out of a sense of we have to do something to defend our people. I mean, what had happened in October, November, and December was really awful. And so they armed themselves with scythes and sticks, and I guess they had a few homemade guns. There are some who are making claims to, I mean, there is a group, it's called ARSA, A-R-S-A. It's kind of a recent group that's claiming responsibility for these attacks now. And they allegedly do have some connections in other Muslim countries, but it's not systematically developed yet.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's talk about U.S. involvement in this country, because we have a peculiar dichotomy in our foreign policy. You've got people like Stephen Bannon, who were just on 60 Minutes decrying that the U.S. is not standing up to China. Of course, this is the same administration who got rid of the TPP, which was a way to stand up to China. And the Trump administration have completely abandoned U.S. interest in Myanmar, Burma. And now the Chinese are rapidly filling the vacuum. If the Chinese overreached, the Burmese were upset with this dam project. The Americans saw an opening. They moved in. Mm-hmm. They were engaged for a while. They brought about this democratic election and the reduction of the influence of the military. But now Trump and company are completely abandoning it, and China is taking over. Is that a summary?
Well, I think China's been they've been taking over for a long time. The military state, or the state under the military for many years, was developing into a kind of client state status. And mm-hmm. there was a lot of grumbling about Chinese influence until this current situation developed that has kind of deflected attention away from the degree to which the Chinese are influencing. The most important thing that's been happening is that the Chinese built a pipeline for both gas and oil. It runs from the Romery Island on the Arakan coast all the way up to Kunming. And so they see Myanmar as strategic for them now. Myanmar becomes, in a sense, the possibility for them to have access to the Bay of Bengal.
And the Indian Ocean, right?
Yeah, and the Indian Ocean. And then, you know, India itself is kind of worried about this. And so just this last week, Prime Minister Modi was in Myanmar expressing his solidarity with the Burmese government. And, you know, given his background, that's not completely surprising, given his stance and his own history in India with in relation to Muslims. Mm-hmm. I can say that, you know, I talked to the leading nationalist monks, militant monks in Myanmar, and they were absolutely delighted at Donald Trump's election and his stance towards preventing Muslims from coming into the United States or attempting to. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the geopolitical situation had an impact in Myanmar. And, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi was quite friendly with President Obama. President Obama twice came to Myanmar during his time and lifted the sanctions in, I think it was September 2015, or the last of the sanctions. That's when we all had, everyone had some hope that her party's election would send things in a new direction. It is true she's hamstrung. I mean, there's no gainsaying that. I think what bothers the Rohingyas is that they've been totally precluded from engaging in any process with regard to forging a solution. Mm. You know, they couldn't run for parliament. They couldn't even vote, most of them, in the last election. Sure.
Well, we've run out of time, but I thank you for filling us in on what's happening. And again, I've been speaking with a specialist on Burma, Myanmar, a prominent scholar, made many trips to the country, is now writing a book on the Buddhist-Muslim conflict, but prefers to remain nameless because he has intimate contacts with political leaders inside Burma, Myanmar, who may well be persecuted by the government, which is dominated by the military. I thank you for joining us. We're going to take a brief station break and back on this 16th anniversary of 9/11, assessing the effectiveness of the trillion-dollar response to the terrorist attacks. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. John Mueller, who is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of political science at The Ohio State University. His books include Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. And his latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mueller.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And on this 16th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, President Trump, of course, went to the Pentagon, made a speech saying on that day, not only did the world change, but we all changed. Our eyes were opened to the depths of the evil we face. But in that hour of darkness, we also came together and renewed purpose. Our differences never looked so small. Our common bonds never felt so strong. I suppose that may have been true shortly after 9/11, but we certainly live in a divided country. What's your sense of what the trillions we've spent on the war on terror have got us? Where are we today, 16 years later?
Well, basically nothing, or very close to it, particularly if you're dealing with Homeland Security expenditures in the United States, which are basically top $3 trillion since 9/11. There's a huge amount of money going into it, and the total number of people killed by terrorists is about 6 people per year. I asked a friend of mine who's fairly high up in the National Institutes of Health, suppose you had an illness that killed 6 people a year, how much money would you spend on trying to eradicate it? And he looked at me like, you know, I was crazy or something. Obviously, that's an incredibly small number, tragic though those individual deaths would be. It also does not seem to be at all the case that the number is that low because of these expenditures. I looked at all the cases of Islamist terrorists in the United States, and there's something like 90 to 100 of them. Of these, about 20 or 21 or so actually are carried out to fruition, which is where we got the six deaths per year. Then of the remaining 70 or so, when you look at these cases, everybody that does it basically looks at it carefully, comes to the same conclusion. These guys are pretty unlikely to be able to do much of anything. They tend to be incompetent. They tend to be misguided. They tend to be mercurial. They tend to be incapable. So even if all those people basically have not been stopped, some of them might have been able to do something. So instead of only 6 people per year, maybe we'd get up to 12 or something like that. Nor does it seem that the security measures have deterred terrorism. That's basically impossible. They have certainly deterred terrorism, in all probability at any rate, against airplanes, I'm in an airport now, so I can testify to that. So there's certain targets that have been basically made essentially substantially secure, military bases and airports and airplanes. But as has been demonstrated repeatedly by terrorists, the world is filled, including the United States, is filled with potential targets. So the idea that although there may have been some deterrence of people who wanted to attack airplanes, what they could do, assuming they were dedicated terrorists, would in a matter of microseconds find another target, a stadium of people, a church, an assembly hall, a security line at the airport before security. Cafes on the sidewalk, cafes as they found in Paris. So no terrorist could possibly be deterred by the fact that the security is so good. They might be diverted from targets which are somewhat protected or very protected to ones that aren't. But if your goal is to kill people to make a political point, which is what terrorism is about, it's hard to see how they could have been. You might say they've been slightly inconvenienced, but they certainly haven't been kept from being doing what they seem to want to do. So it seems to me that the deterrence argument is basically fallacious. And the people we have picked up and know about indicates that the total number of people likely to have been killed, even if these people had not been picked up, is likely to be pretty small. 6 or 12 or 18 or 20 people a year is a tragedy for those people and their families, obviously, but it's not a very monumental hazard. It's a really extremely limited one.
Well, one of the things I find extraordinary about the trillions we spent on the war on terror, and after all, we got into two wars, one in Afghanistan, that's the longest war in American history, and there's no end in sight, and we're certainly not making any progress there, and then on top of that, of course, the Iraq War, which has only benefited Iran and has unraveled the entire Middle East and drawn us further into that quagmire. But the one thing that
has resulted in the deaths of 100,000 or 200,000 people, too.
Right.
Those people would not have been killed if it hadn't been for the American War.
Right. Well, it's probably even greater than that, but and the death toll continues as we speak.
You're right.
As the remnants of ISIS are killed with all the collateral damage that ensues. But we never talk about the underpinning, the ideological and religious underpinning of these people. They are driven by a perverted version of Wahhabism, which is in the Saudi national religion, Saudi Arabia being the only country that practices Sharia law. Why is it that we don't, Donald Trump went to Saudi Arabia, had the best time of his presidency, I think. His daughter was given $100 million by the boy king, Mohammed bin Salman, for her foundation. And they're just throwing all kinds of money at the Trump campaign. And they're also buying weapons at, the most expensive weapon systems in the world. So we know about the oil, but what is this denial that we have about not wanting to talk about who organized, funded, and how come 15 of these 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia? And we've never really looked into that connection in any serious way.
That may have some impact, particularly in the Middle East, but overall within the United States, the motivating thing is not particularly religion per se, but the feeling that by its invasion, particularly of Iraq, the United States has launched a war against Islam, against their people. So that doesn't get reported. It basically, from the get-go, George Bush is able to sell the line that they hate our freedoms. They don't give a damn about our freedoms. They just don't want us in the Middle East pulverizing Arabs and engaging in what they see as to be a war on Islam. I don't think that's what it is. Obviously, the United States hasn't been closing down mosques, but that's the way they see it. And over and over again, when you talk to these people, that's exactly the same. That's the message they give them. We're fighting back. We're soldiers trying to defend our way of life and our religion and our people. The Wahhabi thing may feed into that, but to call it, you can call it wanting to defend your people an ideology, I suppose. But that seems to be much more the motivating fact overall. So the precipitating thing is there was very little of this with the attack on Afghanistan, which is often seen to be justified by many religious Muslims, given the attack on 9/11. But certainly with the attack on Iraq, it would seem to be using Afghanistan as a further stepping stone to attack Muslims, and that's basically the way they see it overall. So I'm not sure how much important the Wahhabi thing has been in this overall indication. Mostly these guys are not very religious, including the ones who even go to ISIS. They're not very sophisticated, certainly, and they're certainly not very good at theology. But they have this sense of participating in something that will that'll come to dominate in an effective way in the Middle East. It doesn't work out that way, but that's the way they certainly see a lot of it.
So what do you think will happen when they've finally taken Raqqa and rounded up the last remnants of ISIS? It looks like the Assad government is going to celebrate a victory of sorts soon in Syria. Iraq's all but eliminated the last of them. What will we do without the terrorists? I mean, this is the amazing thing. We spend more on defense today than we spent during the Cold War, when we had a real enemy, the Soviet Union, that could have wiped us off the map within 30 minutes. Every American city was targeted around the clock on a hair trigger. And we survived real threats, but we're spending more on these largely imaginary threats, and nobody seems to question our military budget.
I partly disagree with that. I think all the threats have been imaginary. You're quite right. The Soviet Union had a lot of nuclear weapons focused at the United States, but document after document comes out of the Soviet archives indicated they never had in a billion years, a trillion, a quadrillion years, any interest in actually using them. They're only there for defense because the United States was constantly threatening them. They did have an aggressive agenda in the sense of wanting to encourage class warfare. Subversion and things like that, but nothing that could remotely look like World War III with nuclear weapons or without. We're now basically living in a new imaginary enemy, which is the came out of 9/11, And when you ask what's going to happen in the future, it seems to me basically more of the same. What seems to be unlikely is that the change probably has been that after the disasters in both Afghanistan and Iraq, the general perspective is, let's not do that again. It's rather like after Vietnam. Let's not do any more Vietnams, and the United States didn't do them. And I think something like that will happen now with Iraq and the fiascos in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the fears of terrorism are as high now as they've ever been in the United States. I just finished a public opinion study to be published by the Cato Institute in the next couple months. A policy analysis report will be available free on PDF online. And I was quite impressed that when you trace public opinion since 9/11 to the present day, overwhelmingly there hasn't been any difference. So, for example, on September 12th, 2011, the question was asked, do you think that it's likely or very likely that there will be an attack, terrorist attack in the United States that will kill large numbers of Americans? And about 72% say yes. They still say 72%. Even before ISIS came up, the percentage is 72%. If you ask people, do you feel safer? After all, we've been spending $1 trillion to make you say feel safer. People did not feel any safer from terrorism than they did in 2001, 2002, 2003. You ask them, do you worry that you might become a victim, or you or a member of your family might become a victim of terrorism? At the end of 2001, it stood at about 40% of the people who said, I worry about that, even though the chance of being killed by a terrorist had proved to be about 1 in 62 million per year. And that number is still, it goes up and down a little bit with events, but basically it stayed pretty much the same all the way through. What has happened is people have become afraid of this great, spooky international conspiracy, which you can't really extinguish because it's substantially imaginary. And what it's comparable to, I think, is not so much terrorism, normal, you know, domestic terrorism, like, say, Timothy McVeigh at Oklahoma City blowing up an office building there, but rather like concerns about domestic communists during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Even though the domestic communists were doing virtually nothing in the United States except sort of twiddling their thumbs and mumbling and talking about Lenin, people became very concerned as part of this big international conspiracy. And that lasted all the way through the Cold War, even though there was nothing happening. There was no press reports particularly about what the Communist Party was doing in the United States for the simple reason that they weren't doing anything.
Right.
Nonetheless, fears remained high.
Right.
And the other analogy is the ultimate outside force, which is the devil. And for 200 years in Europe, people were afraid of witches, that they were the embodiment or the handmaidens of the devil, the ultimate outside foreign mysterious spooky force. And it took 200 years before that fear went away. So my fear in this situation, my concern in this situation, is we've got a long ride ahead of us.
Well, Dr. John Mueller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of political science at The Ohio State University. His books include Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Cost of Homeland Security. And his latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Lily Walsh. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.